strength, the title of the talk, as you heard, is evolution. And there is a tie on it, that is, whether it is a blind or whether it is intelligent. In other words, whether it is by chance or is it intelligent, that is by certain design behind that evolution. Now this is the kind of disputing statements which was raging in the 18th, 19th centuries. During Espivi's time particularly it was raging at its highest, especially when Darwin introduced his doctrine of evolution. He studied nature for 20 years. He went to various continents, especially to the very deep jungles of Africa, and at close quarters studied the behavior of nature. And therefore the conclusion that he arrived at, that with a scientific mind, was absolutely true. Now observation is one thing, and design is interpretation about what you get out of that observation. The conclusions you draw out of that observation can vary from scientist to scientist. So of course he presented various theses in the early years of his career. These theses led to a lot of disputations among the scientists themselves in the first place, and later on he came in conflict with the religious people of his time. And Espivi took up this debate, this kind of dispute that was going on, took the advantage of the dispute and wrote number of articles, both showing the inner meaning of the religious position and both trying to show where the science is right and correct in his own conclusions, and yet how limited the view the science takes. Then also she punctured some of the pride of the scientists. So some of her writings are very scathing, almost, might say, militant in her language. But that was the time when it was the raging time of, it was not a time of dialogue between the two camps, it was a time of real warfare. And we'll come to that a little later on. So this is by way of an introduction. Now the question is that in that debate, whether it is blind or whether it is intelligent, whether it is by design or by chance. The very, if you refer to the dictionary, and it is there in your write-up, there in your hand, the very definition of evolution itself will clear out the debate itself. You can come to conclusion by yourself. Of course, this is a modern dictionary. Mind you, in that dictionary, the definition of evolution was from a point of view of a biologist and a philosophical definition of evolution. So here is the philosophical subscription. It is described as a systemic development under natural laws by which the known universe has come into existence. So now here philosophically it doesn't deal with man, it just deals with the cosmic level, at the very nature, level of the nature, how nature has come into existence. A development, it's a process of development under natural laws by which the known universe has come into existence and has become what it is today through the redistribution of pre-existing matter and motion. Redistribution of pre-existing matter and motion. That means, is it haphazardly done? Is it fortuitously arranging atoms to produce molecules? And by chance collecting atoms to produce tissues and organisms? Is it that? Or is there an intelligent behavior in nature? This is the issue. So that even if you say that there is a kind of an internal distribution, again one has to prove whether this internal distribution that takes place even within cells or within molecules, or within tissues, or within organisms. This internal rearrangement, does it take place according to pre-existing plan? So the design side of the question will come. But anyway, it comes very close to the view that there is some kind of intelligence, because systemic. Now coming to the definition of systemic, that is another interesting thing. We found system. System means a method of organization. This definition itself shows that there is a technique organized mind yet. A scheme or a systemic law of action. System is a set of things adjusted and regulated as a connected whole. So when we talk of system, and nowadays we talk of systems because of these modern electronic machines, where there is a systems. So that the set of things so arranged and so regulated as connected whole. So this connection naturally you can appreciate cannot be haphazard, cannot be by chance, cannot be fortuitous. And the very word system therefore comes to the conclusion that there is something of an intelligence behind this. You may not call it God, but you can always say there is some intelligence behind that. So this is the first definition of evolution. Now coming to secret doctrine, talking about cosmos, which people say is that the, talking about nature, this is the whole order of nature. Evidences, that is, it has got this evidence of progressive mass towards a higher level. So it's obvious that nature is, if any biologist were to observe nature, he will actually see that out of a simple organism, in a period progress of time, things become more and more complex, and therefore towards higher and higher life. This has become obvious now to modern science. So the whole order is not only at one local area, whole cosmic will moves in that direction of the orderliness. So the order is, it moves towards a higher life. And therefore it culminates in man. That is, if you talk about evolution, then at least the biological evolution culminates or comes to the apex of the development of man so far. So far. You can say that you will still continue because evolution should not stop there, but that we'll see later. And then it should be said, of course, there is a design in the action of seemingly blindless forces. So the question of whether it is blind or by chance or by design, so the answer is, it is design in the action of seemingly blindless forces. And then she gives an evidence. What's the evidence? The whole process of evolution, with its endless adaptation, is a proof of this. Now, we can add a parenthesis that is adaptation according to Newton, according to Charles Darwin, he gave various methods of adaptations. And one of them was a classical method of natural selection. This natural selection is nature's survival strategy. Nature is trying to save life with the best of its ability. In other words, there is that kind of a natural will to go on existing. What philosophy may call tanha or tanhai, desire to exist, desire for life. But this is there in biological evolution. So that selection of useful traits. You see, natural selection of useful traits. Over a long period of time, various traits are adopted by an organism. But then one by one they are thrown out, and only those will remain which are useful for the progress, for the growth, and for the survival of that entity. This is the nature's own internal strategy to keep alive living organisms. An example of, say, the black bears, which at one time, due to climatic changes of tremendous cold invading that area, over a period of time, the whole black skin converted itself into white skin in order to adapt itself fish environment. And that skin color has prevailed still today in the region where there are a lot of snows and Alps. In the snowy areas, the best that you find out whether dry skin. This is a protective mechanism. The survival mechanism by which the animal can continue to exist. In other words, this strategy has got behind it a certain, you might call it a divine will. Philosophically, we can call it divine will. Scientists will say, yes, there is some intelligence behind that. It may dismiss it that way. But then, unfortunately, later philosophers, during time of Darwin, they considered this selection of this selection strategy considered as survival of the fittest. So that only the fit will survive, fit physically. And then you say that fit means among the conflicting animals, only the strongest will survive. And therefore it was applied as the law of the jungle. And clever scientists and materialists adopted this as a practice of life. They said, how in nature? It is only the strong will survive. The weaker must get out. They have no place in this world. Now this kind of cold-hearted interpretation of a scientific statement actually took place during H.P.B.'s time, and H.P.B. is very strong in her condemnation of that situation. But then Darwin himself showed that this struggle for existence is not only continually a struggle. There is what is called synergism. That has been observed. Synergism means organisms support each other's life. They cooperate with one another, they coexist and they cooperate with one another in order to support each other's life. And we have an example of a mistletoe, which is supposed to be a parasite living on the alpine tree. A small growth of plant. It has its roots embedded into the plant, into the trunk of the tree, and absorbs the sap out of this. To that extent, it is depriving the big plant, and therefore it is called a parasite. But in return, amazingly enough, it also contributes to the welfare of that plant by certain enzymes that it introduces. It injects into that plant, into the alpine tree, certain hormones by which those trees on which these parasites were found were taller, stronger and living longer. This shows that there is mutuality, there is a kind of a mutual help going on in nature. So that all along there is not always in nature a struggle for existence, that there is not the law of the jungle all the time. There is such a thing, even in nature, animals survive on each other's mutuality. And therefore, of course, if we can apply ethically to human situation, certainly we cannot say that survival of the fittest and the law of the jungle should prevail cold-heartedly. Now, then we go to the third reading, which again is very enlightening, because that comes from another scientist, that is Isaac Newton. But mind you, he is a physicist and a physical philosopher. And he had a mystical insight. This is taken from an article called Mystical Insight of Newton, which is found in Theosophical Digest. He writes, whence, means from where, is it that nature doth nothing in vain? There is some intent, there is some purpose. Whence it is that nature does nothing in vain? And whence arising order, beauty, we see everywhere? And does it not appear from phenomena that there is a being incorporeal, intelligent, omnipresent, who is within infinite space? So this is a kind of a mystical insight. A scientist observes things and then rationalizes things, coming to conclusion through rational process. Here is a scientist who has a direct vision, a kind of an insight by which he sees that there is intelligence, and then he calls it a being. A scientist will dread to call this a being, but he dared to do it. And this is a kind of an evidence-based conclusion. But he is not alone. that have been ancient scientists from long ago. They have been observing nature for millennia of years, sharing their conclusions with one another. They were spiritual scientists in the sense that they not only used physical eyes and the physical organs to examine nature, but they had unfolded within themselves certain psycho-spiritual faculties by which they could examine objects and come to right conclusions. And we can give a very direct example from Ayurveda, that Ayurveda, the Veda of science, which deals with medical herbs. Those ancient rishis used to hold a herb in his hand and go into meditation and would tell the property of that herb by just having an insight into the very essence of that herb, the very soul of that herb. In other words, whether it is hot or cold, whether it is pitta, kapha or vayu, whether it is heavy or light, whether it helps digestion or not, and so on. All its vitality and all its power, and how much vitality it has in it, the vital force in it, the living force in it, and how much it can transmit on the human body. So all the properties of herbs that are there in that the textbooks of Ayurveda, they are coming up to not through what chemical laboratories. Of course, today by chemical laboratory you can say that yes, they were right. But otherwise, they came to conclusions through that insight, through that inner faculties which was developing then. So in other words, you can arrive at conclusions by observing nature through other faculties other than the sense perceptions. Now, such a perception is described by Mr. Jell as someone, it's not there in your writing. But see, he says that all nature is sentient, is living, pulsating with life. That a vast array of objects and men are not mere collections of atoms, fortuitously, that is by chance, thrown together, and then without law, and therefore without law evolving law. It's not by chance, but there is a law prevailing. But down to the smallest atom, all his soul and spirit, ever evolving under the rule of law, which is inherent in the whole. In other words, that SPB says that whole universe, and then he further says that of course whole universe exists for the experience and the emancipation of the human soul. This again is an insight. That though you can imagine the whole universe, for the sake of one human man, ordinary man, little man. Sir James James, in his book called Mysterious Universe, he is staggering to imagine the multiple magnitudes of the cosmos, the multiplicity of stars, millions and millions and millions of them. Can they be just haphazardly placed by chance and also purposelessly? And not only that, but puny man compared, a little earth is compared to it, not even a grain of sand, smaller than a grain, the atom within the sand. So small an earth, can you imagine the whole cosmos for the sake of a human evolution? But that it is an insight which the great ones have arrived at. That man, of course, on earth is the crown piece of evolution. But then there must be purpose behind this whole evolutionary pyramid, from the lowest to the highest. When it comes to the pinnacle, the crown piece comes physical, biological, maybe, intelligent, yes. But then there is something greater than that which is in him. That is for whose purpose this universe exists. That means this is a field of action. The whole universe or the earth is the field in which it's a karma field, it's a karma kshetra. So this is how philosophy, of course, therefore, has a mystical view of things. It's not mere mystifying like the church behavior. They are not trying to mystify people, it is actual insight. And those who have got that kind of insight, particularly poets, they have arrived at certain conclusions about nature and man. Therefore, they are very close to nature. And when they are close to nature, there is a kind of interchangeability between the nature. The nature talks to them, they talk to nature, silently. And they arrive at certain conclusions, spontaneously on their own, and of course express that in a poetic diction. So now, coming to the thesis that whether it is lying or intelligent. Now we need not go any further than that on this argument, that ultimately nature of course has got behind it design, and when we say design, it actually means a plan and a purpose. The very by definition, you see, I design to make so and so. That is, I have a plan, but that I have a goal in front of me. So nature has got certain goal, and we have just summed up now in a very brief way that the whole universe exists for the emancipation of the soul. And therefore, so this conflict of these three views of evolution on philosophical side, as we have just mentioned, the religious and science conflict between the two, this conflict we have to now face, at least between science and religion. Now, Newton, of course, when we mention it, we can say further that Newton also was a religious man. And therefore, he has observed that about his writing, but Newton has written at places about that man does not, you see, the evolution does not end with man, but that it still continues. And therefore he says, there is something more in man than the mere breath in him. Because in Bible they speak about the breath that is put into the kind of a non-living human form. The God breathed his life into him and the man came into being. So this kind of thing happened with Newton, that he comes to this conclusion, there is something more in man than the mere breath in him. Then he says, I believe that in the distant future, man will be far more perfect than he is now. In other words, he was able to visualize the great possibilities of human perfection. I'm sorry, I am talking of Darwin. Please forgive me. This is from Darwin. Charles Darwin, a religious man. Newton too was a religious, deeply religious man. But Darwin says in his thesis, In the Descent of Man, and some of his letters. Now when Newton, this Charles Darwin, published a thesis called The Descent of Man from A in the year 1871, a lot of debate took up, a raging debate took place between religion and science. A tremendous conflict burnt up, suddenly came to the surface. Mind you, he wrote that thesis 11 years earlier, but he kept it, he was afraid to publish it, because he didn't want to hurt the feelings of the religious people, because he was himself a religious man. So he didn't want to publish it, but then the other friends and scientists pleaded with him to put it in paper. So they listened to him when he says that the man by law descends according to it from some kind of animal body which comes very closely resembling the ape. He didn't openly and deliberately say, he may say it looks like ape-like being. And of course later in evolution he said that there must have been a intermediary, what is called the missing link. And so far we have not been able to find a link between that ape on one side and man on the other, that is what is called the ape man. So the fossils and all those things are found, but they are more of human form, and definitely of human form on one side of the animal form on the other, developed animals, but there is no intermediary between the two. So this conflict between religion and science at that time was raging. So the position of the religion was at the time was of the, that is found of course in the Bible, was called the book of Genesis. In that the God is supposed to be created because of an act of creation. So he produces the whole universe by an inner act of creation. And that has taken place within 7 days. And of course it is described that, of course, it's a biblical way of describing it, but it says there's actually 7 periods. But then it is folly to say that God produced the whole earth in 7 days and on the 7th day he rested.
The scientific view is that it has taken millions and millions of years even to produce the earth. To condense the earth, it took millions of years. And the condensed earth, encrusted earth, is now 300 million years old. And man is on earth, according to the modern scientists, is about 4 to 8 million years old. But according to the theosophical view, the living, conscious, thinking man is 18 million years old. So it's a folly to say that God created man by merely breathing into him at once. It's one-time action. And then the whole humanity, or whole, once when you say man, it means of course the race. The whole race of man was produced overnight. And the earth was produced in 7 days time. On the seventh, on one day, we of course produced the man. The last thing we produced was man. And therefore the church view is that there is a kind of a providential view or will of the Creator which produces it. And of course you can't question God, it's a mystery of God, and therefore you cannot question. This is the church position. On the other hand, as we just saw, that scientific view is that course it's a process of development, unfolding, and the law. So we have a position on that in your hand. It says, and that is of course a biological evolution, as I just mentioned from the dictionary. It says various types of organisms have developed by descent with modification, as you just saw, no? Through natural selections, mutations, etc., from pre-existing types. This is an important thing, from pre-existing types. See, the present types that we see are the product of already existing germ types, what in philosophy we call the archetypes. So there have been pre-existing types which have already existed, and we do not know exactly which these types are. Occasionally we find the fossils of them. We do find the fossils, and we find that they may be the previous types, out of which the present animal has been produced. So then it is a kind of a process of development and not creation. So creation is an act of one time production out of nothing, whereas it is producing out of already existing organisms, already existing seeds. And therefore, when you say evolution means already existing seed, it really unfolds itself, folding itself out. Emanates, ejects out, breaks open, and then develops into a better and wiser and better and more complex organism. A simple breaks down into more complex organism. A moth becomes a butterfly. A seed becomes a plant. Now this is a process of evolution. Unfolding. That which has been folded round is folding out. So we have to talk about what exactly is evolution. The very word evolution means evolve, to come out. That it has been, I mean literally, E means out and volvere means to roll, unroll. That means like a roller parchment which is rolled out, you unroll it. Similarly you unfold things which has been a little folded. So within the seed, the whole tree is there. Modern science will say genetically coded. But there is really a plant within that. There is a, you might say, mystical plant. It's imprinted in each seed that this seed is going to produce that particular plant. And each seed has its own genetic plant. So that means this inner existing plant is already there, and it is a matter of unfolding. Now, so if you go to the fourth reading, yes, I was going to go to that. Therefore, we said that it is a development from a pre-existing plan, and therefore descent by modification. Similarly, when Darwin talked about the descent of man from apes, he did not categorically say that. He has been blamed, and people, scientists have conveniently taken it up. And there is a lot of joke behind that. And we can tell about that little event which happened during that debate. You see, in England, at one separate time, there was a debate going on. That's why we have got sometimes what is called the Parliament of Religions, where religions have the debate among themselves. So there was a huge group of religion scientists gathering on one side and really intelligent, intellectually developed the church fathers. They were assembled at one debating session, and it was headed by Samuel Wilber, Bishop of Oxford, and Thomas Huxley, whom supported it. He says, and now Thomas, when the debate was going on, almost at the end, to wind up, the bishop said, and he looked at the scientist, Zepton, and says, "Aren't you ashamed of having an ape as your grandmother?" He was just taunting them. Thomas Huxley, when he's taunting, he says, "There is no reason to be ashamed of having an ape as your grandmother, but I should be ashamed to plunge into scientific question without thorough study of the subject." So he was telling them that you religious people have not taken real pains to study, to take the book which is that theory of evolution by Darwin. You have not taken pains even to study. Or you have at the second hand knowledge you have got, and now you are coming into the debate. Because from the debate you could immediately find out that they were ignorant people as far as the scientific view is concerned. So I should be ashamed to speak about things without genuinely studying it, rather than being ashamed of having an ape as my mother. And Huxley, of course, came to a very great conclusions by observation. You see, when you observe things, as you say, you come to rational conclusions. But sometimes with insight, you can also arrive at an intuitive conclusions. And this also comes to that. Of course, you are rational. This is the logic of evolution now. And Mr. Jett gives it, calls it what is called the logic of evolution in his Ocean of Philosophy, in the very second page of his book. I cull from that, Huxley's words. "There must be advanced beings in the universe whose intelligence is as much beyond ours as ours exceeds that of the black beetle." You can imagine how much development we have taken out of this little black beetle. We have now evolved into human beings. There must be beings in this world of cosmos. How can you say they cannot be? There must be beings whose intelligence is extraordinarily far superior to us, as much as the distance between beetle and man. Between man and that superman, there must be high intelligence. Possible. How can you deny it? There can be a possibility. Now this, a scientist speaks with great responsibility. So that he says it is purely a logical evolution, that why should the evolution stop with man? That there can be further unfoldment. After all, biological evolution comes up to the apex of man. Okay. But then, over a period, and man has taken 18 million years to become what he is today. There may be other million years to develop, unless the earth, of course, dissolves itself. Other millions of years for man to develop a superior man. And that is the position taken by theosophists. So that this church position that man is born in sin, right from the very beginning, as the biblical statement says, that Adam, the first race of man, Adam was represented the first race of man, that he is born in sin through sexual development. And therefore he is inherently imperfect, and therefore he has continually to rely on the religious teachers, intermediaries like priests and God, and all sorts of things, a kind of dependence to be developed outside. So that God is down up there, outside, completely separated. Whereas in evolution we speak about a really existing germ out of which things are taken. So the philosophical view is that there must be something pre-existing, a plant, a kind of what is called the archetypes in cosmos, which are abstract ideas which can develop themselves as they grow on gradually into ethereal forms. Out of the ethereal forms they may develop further into astral forms, further concretized into mineral forms. And then, and once mineral forms is there, there is a jump between the mineral and the first living organism. This is another mystery science is not able to unveil. How from the mineral animal plant came, took place. Thereafter various theories regard that how on earth life came into existence. So having got that unicellular life, now that unicellular life, a simple life, develops further and further into plant kingdom, animal kingdom, comes to human form. Then human form is man, a man in human form, but as yet not man in mind. Another mystery. Now how that animal man becomes a human man, a thinking man, a choosing man, a thinker in his own right. So this is another jump. And here Secret Doctrine expresses that even the whole cosmic evolution that takes place has taken place not only on the intelligent plan, but guided by divine intelligences. That as an act of emanation, there is a doctrine of emanation, as an act of emanation, the universes are produced. At the same time, never heard the primal seven emanations. They are the highest intelligences you can think about. Of course, Bible talks about the archangels, the Christians talk about the suspenders, the highest you can think of. They are taking part in the government of the natural order of things. They not only take part, but they are the actual intelligences who are behind the whole cosmic development. So it is not haphazard. There is a whole intelligence behind this planning and unfoldment over a long, long period through the guidance of those intelligences. So once this impulse is given for the evolutionary progress, this impulse is not merely a blind intelligence, but continually being guided and coded. So that out of, as you said, the mineral atom, a living organism takes place, there must be at one stage an intelligent intervention. Similarly, a great intervention really took place, what is known as the descent of an Agnishvata Pitris, who actually informed themselves into the human forms and lighted up the human mind, which was at that time in latency. The manasic part of man was in latency. It lighted. When you say lighted, it means like a candle. With one candle, you can light a multiplicity of candles. So that they, in that turn, they were found that there were candles which are waiting to get lighted. They were ready. They were ready processing. So when a man was ready informed to be lighted up, they came, and over a long period, and it is still going on, by the way. This process of lighting up is still going on. So they lighted up the mind. And when that mind was lighted up, mind became a thinking being. From that on, the responsibility of man's own. Because the moment that mind is awakened in him, a kind of an inner conjunction took place between him and his father in heaven, which is the intermediary between his lower incarnated mind and the divinity which is overruling over him. And this, regarding this divinity, the devotional being speaks about a whole stream of evolution taking place. See how it describes it? It is the primal spirit from which flows the never-ending stream of conditioned existence. That is at the highest level. So a stream, and then there are rivulets, and there are further streams and further streams. And that in each stream there is a single unit of life. That stream is a living stream, mind you, because it comes from a primal spirit, primeval spirit. And then he says, it is even a portion of myself out of that, which having assumed life in this world of conditioned existence, joined together five senses and the mind, in order that it may obtain a body and may live it again. So that this single unit of life which ejected out of the whole ocean of life, for this whole cosmos is pervaded by that one single universal principle of divine life. And that divine life is pulsating everywhere within every single atom. So that it is not down up there, but it is down here, encased within the gross materiality, and therefore not visible to us. And it is for us to be able to reach out to it with the help of this awakened manas in man. So this portion of myself is described in theosophy as monadic light, the monadic entity. And therefore monad, of course, is defined in our write-up. It is a unit, unity or the one. But in occultism, it means a unified triad and a dual, that immortal part of man which reincarnates first in the lower kingdoms, then gradually progresses through them right up to man. And this is half the story. Further now, and then ascends to the final world, Nirvana. So that it doesn't end there. And further he says, and that which propels towards and forces evolution, propels and forces evolution and compels man towards perfection is that monadic light, the spark of unity within each cell, within each atom. And in man it is called human mind, which acts, of course, with the help of the higher mind, which acts in it unconsciously through the force inherent in itself. So the really existing impulse is there within every atom to come to fruition. Just as within every seed, there is already a plan, there is already a desire, there is already a will, there is already an aspiration to become the whole-blown plant. There is in man an already hidden aspiration, secret desire to unfold itself and become Superman, to reach out to his parents and become one with it. So this impulse in us is there, and man can take an advantage of that. So that last Sunday, as we saw, we talk about the human progress, that it's not that individual only makes progress. He contributes to the collective progress because he is a part of the whole. So that whole and the part are so cosmically interlinked and interconnected that each atom is connected with us, and that each man is connected with the whole of the universe. And therefore a continuous exchange going on of a transmission of ideas, thoughts, feelings, desires. And to that extent, we are either making or marring the progress of others. So that each time we rise superior to our individual feelings, we help to that extent the rising of the whole of humanity. And each time we fail, of course we drag down others along with us. Of course, talking about the final destiny of man, we can end that from the key to theosophy, from strength to strength, from the beauty and perfection of one plane to the greater beauty and perfection of another plane, with accessions of new glory, of fresh knowledge and power at each cycle, such is the destiny of the ego. So this is, we can take up your questions now.
So in human being, the law of karma works to maintain harmony. But in other kingdoms, what law keeps and maintains this harmony, especially between kingdoms?
I hope I need not repeat it. But here you are applying the law of harmony or the law of karma. So you mentioned about law of karma, whose other name is law of harmony. The harmony is the pan ultimate law, because ultimately leads to harmony. So what is law of harmony, law of karma? The law of causation. That for every act, for every action, for every movement, there is always a corresponding reaction. Given a medium, there is always a reaction. And always we are given an example of a stone throwing. It goes back and then comes back to the same point. So reaction does come. Applied to man at a moral level, a reaction comes to man. Now you said, how does it apply to the lower kingdom? There is a law of physics, of course. Newton's law of causation is that for every action, there is a corresponding reaction. You give push to a thing, it pushes you back. But if it fails to push you back, that is an inertia. You see, this is stable and inert, apparently inert, it is not mobile. It is mobile, immobile, because it is now in a balanced state. Things are pushing to it and it is resisting it. And between the two, it has remained stable. So the law of inertia which Newton mentioned is that things become stable because between the two forces, suppose you push two hands together, you can't move them. See, it is stable. Tremendous force on both sides, but it is not mobile. So action and reaction are neutralizing each other and therefore there is inertia. So even in nature, in fact, physical sciences are allied at this law of karma, which is applied at a moral plane. Ethical, it's an ethical law of causation. But at a physical level, it is obvious, we can see it in daily life, that every action has its corresponding equal and opposite reaction. So as far as that is concerned, it is quite obvious. And that means there is intelligence behind that. So that, had it not been, what could have happened? Imagine, if you push a thing, it will go on being pushed away. Even the very gravity, there won't be even a gravity. Gravity works thanks to I'm pushing my whole weight on the earth and the earth is pushing its own weight on me. It's only when I'm away from the earth that I become weightless to that extent. I'm floating. So this gravity is a kind of a powerful force which is pushing on us. In fact, the theosophy says that there is a whole life pressing itself on human body. And then when the body is all saturated with that life, it becomes sleepy and goes into sleep. And when that balance takes place under the law of karma, that balancing takes place, he wakes up. Any more questions? We have got only 1 minute.
What about the natural impulse in the lower kingdom?
Yeah, this is some point I feel. That, so that nature unfolds itself, the impulse is there in nature itself. That impulse is not imposed from outside. It is inherent, as I mentioned every time we mention about the seed. That within every seed, within every germ, there is a natural desire to unfold itself. So it has its own impulse. It is not imposed from outside. In that sense, it is natural. In human case, he has to take his own evolution in his own. So that unfoldment or evolution of the lower kingdom or kingdom up to man takes place by the natural flow. It may take millions and millions of years to come to what man is. But once a man, and always a man by the way, he cannot go there. This is another very important idea. Once having become a conscious human being, a conscious thinker, a chooser, an experiencer, within him is given the free will and choice, because now the light is awakening him by the great sacrifice of the Anishwata Pitris. So now once the light is awakened, he becomes a responsive individual. Now he has to take evolution in his own. Not that the natural evolution doesn't work in him. It works in him in a physical, at a physical level. But at a mental and a moral level, it is his responsibility to unfold himself.
Go ahead, mention Karim Gautam. Would you go to the center?